And good morning to everyone. Our first case this morning is Gonzalez-Valadez versus Hansen. Mr. Samuelson, good morning to you. You may approach and you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Mike Samuelson from Reynolds, Corth & Samuelson here this morning on behalf of the appellants in this case. This matter comes to you on a case out of Douglas County, and the issue before Your Honors here this morning is a jurisdictional issue, specifically a personal jurisdiction issue concerning the appellants in this matter, but the defendants in the original proceeding. I'd like to begin this morning's analysis with the appropriate standard of review to be applied by this court. There were some what I would call irregularities in the district court proceedings. Defendants filed a motion to dismiss, asserting, among other matters, a lack of personal jurisdiction. What complaint in this matter was filed in 2014 in August. September of 2014, there was a motion to dismiss filed that included, as one of the bases, a lack of personal jurisdiction. Matter was submitted. No ruling was ever received on that, presumably due to the lapse of time and the fact that no ruling was ever received. I think it's reasonable to assume that motion was denied approximately 1 week before the matter was set for trial, and this would have been approximately 3 years later. Defendants filed an answer in the case, generally denying the allegations as set forth in the complaint. The matter proceeded.
Is there no explicit indication in the record that the motion was ever denied?
There was, Your Honor, and quite frankly, had there been some sort of an order or anything dealing with the motion to dismiss, it would have been included in the record for purposes of the appeal, but there was, we can't produce something that doesn't exist as far as a record. There was a transcript from the proceedings that day that was included as part of the bill of exceptions in the case, where the court had given the parties an opportunity to submit arguments, and then the matter.
That was the argument on the motion to dismiss, correct, for which the trial court gave you all an opportunity to submit briefs, and correct, then we can't seem to find an explicit ruling. Is that your understanding?
That's correct, Your Honor, and that sort of should give Your Honor's reason why. And notwithstanding the fact that the matter was filed in August of 2014, a motion to dismiss was filed the next month later. That would also give Your Honors an explanation as to why an answer in the case wasn't filed for 3 years.
So the next pleading, wasn't there a motion or an order to show cause why the case should not be dismissed for lack of prosecution?
There was.
So is that an implicit denial of the motion to dismiss?
I think either that or simply the fact that no ruling was ever given on it, the matter was set for trial, shortly before trial the defendants filed an answer.
Did the answer preserve the argument made in the motion to dismiss?
We believe it did, Your Honor, because at that point...
Through which allegations in the answer?
Excuse me?
Through which express statement in the answer or allegation in the answer did you preserve that issue?
As far as the defendants, the appellants in the matter concerned, I believe it was asserted in the answer. And pardon me if it wasn't, but I believe it wasn't. And again, this was shortly before trial, where actually the court had indicated, hey, you guys need to get an answer on file. We're going to
let's
trial.
Let's assume that the answer does not say anything about preserving the jurisdictional issue. Under our ancient case law, what would that have meant?
As far as the lack of that inclusion in the answer that was filed?
Yes.
To address that, Your Honor, I think, and I assume the implication the court's getting at as well, if it's not specifically addressed in the answer, then the issue is whether or not that matter is deemed waived. I would point out to Your Honors that as far as the trial is concerned, before the matter even proceeded to before any evidence was presented for purposes of those proceedings that day, before opening statements were even given to address the evidence that was going to be elicited during the course of the trial that day, the motion was renewed again and said, Your Honor, trial court judge, we believe that the court does not have personal jurisdiction over the particular defendants in this case. We believe that there's insufficient minimum contacts with the state of Nebraska, so that...
That's a nice summary of what you did at trial.
Sure.
What I'm interested in is to follow up on Justice Stacy's question. Assuming the answer that was filed did not specifically say anything about the absence of personal jurisdiction, isn't under long-standing case law, isn't jurisdiction waived? And it really doesn't matter if you try to resuscitate it at that point. Isn't that the case?
I don't believe so. I don't believe so, Your Honor. But again, without looking at the answer, I wasn't aware of the fact that that issue, as far as that issue, that it was somehow the contention was going to be that it wasn't the answer. I thought it was. I apologize. I can't answer it any further than that as far as the matter is concerned. But in any event, matter proceeded to trial. At the conclusion of the trial, the court entered an order in favor of the plaintiff for $25,000. Now, I'd like to discuss a little bit as far as the jurisdiction question arises. You know, some of these individuals, for instance, a judgment was entered against a Jeremy Hansen and a Josh Hansen. As far as the trial proceedings were concerned, there was minimal reference to those individuals throughout the course of those proceedings. I think during as far as the transcript is concerned, the actual trial testimony is concerned, passing references to them during the course of the trial, saying, "Hey, you know, I met him. He seemed like a nice guy. He was the skinny one," or you know, things along those lines were really the only references that were made to several of the appellants, and specifically the sons in this case, which would have been Jeremy Hansen, who was one of the appellants on the appeal, and also Josh Hansen.
So how does this relate to any of your assignments of error?
Well, as far as the personal jurisdiction issue is concerned, you know, in the absence of any evidence of ties to the state of Nebraska, in other words, at the time of trial when the personal jurisdictional issue was raised, at that point, assuming that that portion of the that defense has not been waived, then at that point the burden is on the proponent, the plaintiff, to establish how personal jurisdiction exists at the time of trial. And in this case, there wasn't any evidence elicited concerning their ties to the state of Nebraska. It was simply a passing reference to the fact that, you know, have you met this individual? Yeah, he's the son of Brant Hansen. And that applied to both Jeremy, and it also applied to Josh Hansen, who are the appellants on the appeal, or two of the appellants in these proceedings. So there really wasn't much reference, if any, to these two individuals other than the fact that, hey, you know, this is one of the appellant's sons. So as far as that jurisdictional issue is concerned, again, there's really no reference to how those particular folks have any ties to the state of Nebraska other than the fact that they're related to one of the individuals. And I see I've got about 2 minutes left. I would like to reserve a portion of the time for rebuttal if it would please the court, unless your honors have any further questions at this point.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Crampton, good morning to you.
I'm James Crampton. I'm here representing plaintiffs in this case. I don't think it's probably very often that you get plaintiffs who are named Bam Bam. But that's actually my client, the principal's son's nickname. At any rate, what this case is about is that there was a group of people who operated as Family First Construction. And Family First Construction came to Nebraska. And while they were doing business in Nebraska, they were, as they stated in brief and in trial, record supports that they were in town in Omaha because of a hailstorm, and they were doing construction work, presumably replacing roofs because of a hailstorm. And during that time, they made contact with the plaintiff, Mr. Gonzalez. Gonzalez was mowing for them, and after a period of time, there was some concrete work that he did for them. All of his contacts while he was in Nebraska were face-to-face and person-to-person with Brad Hansen. And I note in brief, and it should be noted that the Family First Construction on the printed materials that they were using did not indicate a corporate status, didn't indicate whether it was an LLC or a corporation or anything else. So, you know, obviously Mr. Gonzalez isn't thinking about it at the time, but it appears to the educated mind that that's operating as a trade name and that that's going to be somebody personal. And I think the record supports that all of the Hansons that were sued in this case were all a part of that organization. I think that that's irrefutable because I think the testimony on the record comes primarily from Brad Hanson about who's who. I want to point out that on argument there, the discussions about Jeremy and having had no contact, there was a check that was issued where there was payment made to the plaintiff for the work that was done. A portion of the price, according to the plaintiff, at any rate, that check was signed by Jeremy Hansen. He's the one who signed the Family First Construction check. So that's not, I don't think that the distinction between Josh and Jeremy is pretty clear because Jeremy signed the check. I think that makes his contact with that organization pretty clear.
You said that early on these folks came to Nebraska, and you've talked about that a little bit, but when you say they came to Nebraska, what, factually, how long were they here? What was their involvement in Nebraska?
Well, they were here long enough to rent a premises, to print business cards, and to go about with the public and offer services.
Business cards showing a 402 area code.
Correct.
Nebraska area code.
Yes.
And while in Nebraska, they hired the appellee.
Correct.
Various jobs?
Originally, he was doing mowing for them. He informed Mr. Brad Hansen that he also did concrete work. And then there was, I think, only one concrete job that he did in Nebraska for the Hansons. And then it was at that point that there were discussions about, I want you to come to Wisconsin and do this.
Does the record show that they had a Nebraska contractor's license?
I think there's a license referenced on one of the documents. I'm afraid I can't answer that.
Okay, and did the trial judge find that the contract was made in Nebraska?
Yes.
And how did he make that determination? Upon what facts?
Well, it was disputed within testimony about where the contract was being made. But that comes down to a credibility thing, and the trial court judge was there and had the opportunity to observe the witness and all of those things that the court has referred to as, you know, the sweat on the witness's brow. But in this case in particular, he was caught lying. His testimony about we had to tear out the concrete because it was defective was clearly a lie, because I produced for it the court order that came in Wisconsin, said that pouring the concrete where it was poured was a violation of a federal regulation. So he was under a court order to remove the concrete that the plaintiff installed for him. Actually, just a portion of it. I think there were other pieces that were still there. And
there was a partial payment before the work was done. Is that right?
That is absolutely untrue. And
was there a wire amount?
There was a testimony from Mr. Brad Hansen that he had wired $10,000. But the evidence, the documentary evidence that he had to show that payment, was a blank check that my client had given to Mr. Hansen blank, not signed, that he said that he got that from him so that he could get his routing number. He provided no evidence that he had made any kind of a wire transfer, and my client denied that such a transfer had ever happened. There was no $10,000 that was ever paid. And the record, just, I think that it's clear that he had a blank check. A blank check doesn't show that any kind of payment. And again, those are factual things. The trial court judge had the opportunity to observe the witnesses, and obviously the fact that he was caught in the circumstances he was with the court order that directly confirmed that he was not telling the truth about why he took the concrete out was something for the court to consider in evaluating his credibility. And I think that that's pretty clear for this court also, credibility evaluation. I think that the record pretty clearly shows that all of these Hansons that ended up being sued were involved with this Family First Construction. I don't know today if Family First Construction is a corporation, an LLC, a trade name, or what it is, because there's nothing that I can find in any records to support that there is such an entity other than the individuals.
Should we look to the defendant's answer to see how they characterize themselves there?
Yes, and it's interesting about the things with the answer. And I guess it's obvious that one could be critical of the trial court for not having expressly ruled upon the motion to dismiss for quite a long period of time. And it was a frustration to counsel as well as it was delay in the period of time that it took for a trial to come about. But that the record is what the record is. The answer was filed, and we proceeded to trial. There's been quite a time lapse from the time that it happened. And obviously, when I was evaluating, what do you do, who do we sue here, practice hint on these things, sue everybody in sight. And I don't think I reached out too far in terms of finding out who it was, because the record shows that these are the people who were involved with this operation of this Family First. And I think the record is abundantly clear that there was an inducement made in Nebraska that said, if you come to Wisconsin and do this work for me, you're going to get paid. My client then gathered up a crew, went to Wisconsin, did a bunch of work, and didn't get paid. They gave him a check, sent him on his way, then stopped payment on the check. And it is important to notice there, too, that there was also a factual dispute with regard to if there were defects, what would happen. And my client's testimony, which apparently the trial court felt was more believable, was that when he said, I'll come out there and fix it, Mr. Hansen's response was, you better not come here, I got a gun. So Mr. Hansen's testimony that there were defects and that my client refused to fix them doesn't stand as holding up for true. And I think they fail on the credibility test there.
Mr. Crampton, do you have any comment about whether or not the jurisdictional issue was preserved?
I think that filing an answer over the motion with or without a ruling does not preserve that issue. And I can say that there was nothing on the record. The matter of the motion to dismiss was addressed on the way into the courtroom, and that it was not preserved when we were into the courtroom. So I don't think the record preserves the issue at all.
Your opposing counsel suggests that the court instructed that an answer be filed. Is that your recollection as well?
I don't have any actual recollection of it. I don't think it's
the court file doesn't, or the transcript doesn't reflect a written order. Was there a direction from the court to, for the defendants to file an answer?
I have no recollection.
Thank you.
On the pretrial submission, the stipulation on the eve of trial, is this correct that amongst the issues for trial, jurisdiction is not named?
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? 1 minute and 44 seconds, Mr. Samuelson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, I've just got one specific point to make that I'd like for the court to be clear on. During the course of the proceedings, and as the trial testimony reflects, the plaintiff, the appellee, in these proceedings, acknowledge the fact that the contract, if you will, for purposes of the work to be performed, was in fact finalized in the state of Wisconsin. So, for purposes of the analysis, I think that's important. The fact that as far as this the work to be done, the scope, that sort of thing, the contract was finalized in the state of Wisconsin, and actually the plaintiff, the appellee, acknowledged as much during the trial court, and I just wanted to point that out for Your Honors.
But on, in the transcript of the order, the trial court found oral contract made in Omaha. Is that correct?
And I know that the order said that there was a contract entered into. I don't recall specifically whether or not it said that the contract was entered into in Omaha, Nebraska. Any other questions this morning?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will go on to the